Hello everybody, thank you for joining us today at our Saturday live stream on South Front. I am Victor Stuhl from Bulgaria and I'll be the host of the show today. I'm with my friend Brian Kalman, who is one of our top military experts, and we have our special guest today, D. Saker. He's one of our friends and key partners of South Front. He's helped us a lot in the past, and especially when we faced a lot of difficulties last year with some cyber attacks and attacks from other places. He's a geopolitical analyst and a regular contributor to the UNZ Review at unz.com. His website is dsaker.is. And I'm going to give the floor to him to introduce more of what he does and how you can help him grow more and support his project.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure. It's the first time, and I think I will enjoy this. I am a blogger right now. I was born in Switzerland in Europe, where I spent a lot of my youth. I basically got my military service completed there. I then went to study in the United States, got a couple of degrees here in strategic studies and military topics, then returned to Switzerland where I worked for a while for the general staff. I also have experience with the United Nations and did different things. Eventually, my incorrect political views made me lose my career. I decided to move to the United States, and I began blogging just because I felt like saying whatever I wanted. And amazingly enough, my blog suddenly became popular because of the events in the Ukraine. Originally, the focus of my blog was actually the Middle East, not the Ukraine. But when things got really terrifying there, I started writing a lot about it. And it helped me that I was fluent in English. I used to be a Cold Warrior, so I knew, quote-unquote, the enemy, the Soviet Union. And now it was Russia, which wasn't an enemy anymore. But I knew pretty much, how the Russian military functions, and I was comfortable with the topic of Russian geostrategy. So that's what I started blogging about, and that's how my blog became more popular with time. So that's a summary of who I am and where I come from.
And just for the audience information, today's topics will be mainly about the U.S.-Russian relations, and that's why we have D. Saker as one of the very good analysts on this topic, and we also have our military experts from South Front, Brian Kalman, and I'll make sure to keep the discussion balanced. So if Brian has some words for the audience, please have the floor is yours.
Well, if you listen to the last few live streams, you've already got my introduction. And if you're a visitor, a frequent visitor to the site, you've seen some of my analysis. I'd just like to say I'm pretty psyched that, we have the Saker today. I started reading, following his analysis and commentary online, right around when the Ukrainian crisis started. And it really opened my eyes to a lot of things that, especially as an American citizen, you don't really think about. And his point of view has been, extremely eye-opening, very refreshing, and it's just great to have him on the show today.
So without further ado, we're going to move to the actual live stream, to the actual topics. And the first thing that we're going to talk about today is the reasoning and the reasons behind the developing crisis of the U.S. and Russian relations. And the first part that I want to discuss with you is what's going on with the new U.S. sanctions against Russia, and what are the real reasons behind them? Saker, what do you think is the main goal of the new U.S. Sanctions against Russia? Why did they come? We didn't expect them. Most of us didn't expect them to come at this time.
I think the reason for the sanctions is not primarily linked to Russia at all. First of all, you'll notice that the sanctions are not only against Russia, they're also targeting the DPRK and Iran and I believe Venezuela, or Venezuela sanctions came in a second phase. The key thing here is that it's an attempt by Congress to do two things. First of all, to sabotage any efforts by President Trump to try to get any kind of dialogue and any kind of collaboration going between Russia and the United States. That, you have to understand, is the primary threat to the U.S. deep state right now. As God forbid peace would break out, or even worse, actually collaboration. So it's a way of trying to sabotage that. Secondly, it is basically destined to try to show the world, the United States, is not weak, that they're still strong, and look, we're lashing at everybody. This is basically similar behavior to a dog who is barking a lot to try to prove that he's a powerful dog. These are highly political motives which deal with petty politics and not with geostrategy. I don't think anybody, not even the craziest of crazies, seriously think that anything would change as a result of his sanctions, not in Iran, not in North Korea, and most definitely not in Russia.
And Brian, what do you think of this? Do you agree with our friend, the Saker?
Yeah, I definitely agree on a lot of what the Saker said. I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, it kind of shows some of the chinks in the armor of the U.S. hegemon. You know, they're starting to become more and more obvious that the hegemonic power status of the United States is starting to slip. And, you know, like the Saker said, you know, God forbid there be any move towards reconciliation or peace breaking out again between Russia and the United States, or, you know, Iran, any sort of rapprochement at all. I mean, the deep state's going to be against that for sure.
And talking about the deep state, and because we usually hear some commentators say that these anti-Trump attempts are coming mainly from the Democratic establishment, but we also see that big parts of the Republican Party are also against Trump. So, and people say that this is actually the real deep state. But for the audience sake, can you explain a little bit what the deep state really is and how does it really work?
Okay, this is a very controversial topic. There are different views on that. I might surprise the audience by saying that my understanding of what the deep state is actually heavily influenced by Marxist ideas, specifically class consciousness. I don't think that deep state is linked to a specific party or to a specific U.S. state agency. I don't think it's necessarily linked to a sector of the economy like the finance or any other category. It's basically people who have a community of interest and who don't necessarily conspire in an organized way together. I don't think there's a place in the United States where the deep state's executive meet and, you know, hatch out plans. I think there's literally a class consciousness of specific elites in the United States who then jointly develop a policy the way in mathematics a vector is the sum result of two or several vectors. I think the U.S. policy, to the degree that there is a single U.S. policy, and that also, by the way, I should open a parenthesis, is changing. We see several U.S. Foreign policies running in parallel. But to the degree that we can identify as a unitary actor something called the deep state, it is basically a subset of the U.S., the real U.S. elites, the people who run this country, and who have a vested interest in specific policies being implemented and other that they should under no circumstance be allowed to happen.
Brian, what's your take on this?
I think the Saker summed it up, you know, very well. There's no group of, you know, shady individuals meeting in a back room somewhere in some country club. You know, it's not that simple. You know, the deep state's been around for a long time, and you know, Trump is not the first president by far to have to deal with the interests of the deep state. You know, Eisenhower dealt with it. He warned the United States, the citizenry about it. Truman also dealt with it. He had a very poignant, I believe it was in the Washington Times or the Washington Post article after JFK's assassination, basically alluding to the powers of the deep state. And JFK, of course, had alluded to it. And it's something that, you know, it's not some group of individuals that, you know, meets on regular basis, like the Saker said. It's interest in the United States, whether it be financial, military, corporate, and government, that as their interests coincide, they steer policy. It's kind of like it's sometimes a parallel government in some ways. And I think, if anything, that Trump's election has pointed out is the deep state is alive and well, and it you know, is the president really in control of the executive branch, or is he really in control of foreign policy? You know, I don't agree with Trump on many issues, and, you know, I think he's so far, you know, been a weak president, but I think his presidency has definitely brought to the forefront or put a spotlight on the fact that, you know, the president's not always in control. There's other interests, other interest groups that are steering foreign policy and domestic mm-hmm. policy and pulling the levers of government and industry and finance.
And then my question to both of you is then, who chose Trump to be the actual president? Which interest groups lied behind Trump in order for him, from an absolute outsider, to become the president of the U.S.?
I mean, that again is highly debatable. I think that Trump was elected almost it was a mistake of the deep state, essentially. They wanted to have Hillary in power, and they decided to have Trump as the most unpalatable and impossible candidate against her, and they just miscalculated the degree of hatred that the American people have for that deep state, and that they would vote for Trump just because he's not Hillary. I think a lot of that happened. Secondly, on a more profound level, I would say that, and that is really important to understand, I've been living in this country for now a total of, 22 years, if you include my college years, and I've been observing it. There's one thing that's really important for our international audience to understand. Most Americans hate the federal government. They might be clueless about, you know, the world geography. They might not be able to organize a third party, even though they've tried. They might still go and vote, and every time vote for the lesser evil, but it doesn't make them blind. They know that the federal government does not represent their interests. This is absolutely crucial. And I think that Trump presented himself as the outsider, and that is something that got a lot of people who would have been otherwise disenfranchised, uninterested, and basically disgusted, to vote for him. It was also, and that's another crucial thing here, it was the vote of the majority of Americans against what I call a coalition of minorities. The way one of the most powerful political tools of the deep state in the United States is that the deep state always caters to minorities, and minorities have that feature. And I mean minority in a very large sense of the word. It can be political, it can be ethnic, it can be even a matter of like catering to the homosexual lobby here, which is very powerful in the United States. Any minority has a feature that the deep state likes, which is it is small and very easy to motivate by a single topic issue. Usually their agenda is very narrow, and it doesn't threaten the deep state. So the deep state basically buys them by catering and representing their views, and in exchange for that, they vote for the deep state on a single issue. Now, what happens then is that normally the deep state gets away with it because the majority has nobody to vote for and is often very divided. A lot of topics here in this country are artificially, heightened mm-hmm. or made hotter just in order to keep some pretense of diversity and political debate going. It could be abortion, could be race, could be gun rights, it could be the control for, the legalization of marijuana. It doesn't really matter what it is. So you have an atmosphere where the minorities, they will vote according to their one single topic, and the majority is hopelessly divided. what happened with Trump, that he was broad enough to get a lot of people to vote for him, and it was a huge slap, I think, for the deep state and for the minorities, because they suddenly realized that there is another United States which has been oppressed and put down for decades now, which still exists and actually wanted to voice, you know, opposition. That's why they freaked out. And that's why they engaged in a campaign which has never seen before like that. I mean, the level of anti-Trump hysteria in this country is absolutely surreal. I mean, I can't think of anything anywhere in the world coming anywhere close to that. And yet, the American people still voted for Trump. And that is something that truly frightened them and something they consider unacceptable. And so they did. And typically, the way that deep state acts is short-term. They're very skilled and very good at tactics, very bad at strategy at long-term. So they made a big mistake. They actually came out. They showed their true face, which worked to a certain degree because Trump is hopelessly, I mean, first of all, he's been neutered essentially in 1 month. They got rid of his most trusted advisors. His policies are paralyzed now. I mean, it's a victory against Trump, but what they're not realizing is that that victory forced them to show their true face. And that is actually, in the long term, might be actually a seminal event, because now it's clear that the elites are, you know, basically willing to organize a lynch mob to go against anybody who is against them. So as long as these were academics or politicians, that was fine. Now it's a man who's president, who's supposed to run the country, who's the White House. And he gets that lynch mob treatment. So I think it's absolutely fascinating to observe that basically the masks are slowly, gradually falling off. And that is a huge development. And if I may add one more thing, I was never a big supporter of Trump. I had hopes, which is very different from expectations. Mm-hmm. I did indeed see a historical opportunity to get an outsider in, and my hope again was that he would do something very similar to what Vladimir Putin did in Russia. When Putin came to power, he understood very clearly who the enemy was. It was the oligarchs. And he immediately cracked down on them. He knew that this was a mortal threat, and he took care of it. My hope was that Trump, who promised to, and I quote, drain the swamp, would do the same thing. Unfortunately, Trump, to put it mildly, was no Putin, and basically the swamp drowned him in, I think, less than a month. I mean, once they fired Flynn, to me it was clear that this was the end. But the hope was there. I think the hope was reasonable. And I think the best example that Trump was not, because some people say, you know, he was sent in, he's an agent, he was always, you know, working. No, look at the panic. I think the man was, in his own way, sincere, at least with his desire to have a better relationship with Russia. I think he was probably surprised by himself, you know, that he was ever elected. And for this, we got to credit Hillary Clinton, who truly showed a maniacal, satanic kind of face, and that's what got him elected. And unfortunately, he's not the kind of man that has the caliber or the qualities to deliver on his actually very good promise to drain the swamp. Unfortunately, it never happened, which is very sad.
And Brian, can you add something on this?
I agree. I pretty much agree with everything that Sager said, you know, and I think I normally do, but, you know, I think he's right that, you know, that the public, the U.S. public, and it goes across the, you know, financial and any demographic divisions you can think of, pretty much would have voted against the establishment, against, you know, the deep state. And it's interesting. I think the deep state really stage managed the election 100%. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party, you know, Hillary was not the favorite candidate in her own party. And if you look at, you know, Democrats or those with a socialist leaning, they didn't want Hillary Clinton at all. They saw Bernie Sanders as the outsider, even though, you know, he's part of the establishment as well. He's bought and paid for. But he had that same persona that he was coming from outside the establishment. And, you know, by in their zeal to get Hillary Clinton in office, you know, they totally stole the Democratic Party's votes and the candidate they wanted, and they made sure that Hillary Clinton was going to be the candidate. That was kind of the first instance where the mask started coming away, and I think a lot of people saw what happened there as well. You know, the establishment is definitely pushing, you know, Hillary Clinton as the president 100%. And their only other option at that point was Trump. Not you know, if you liked Trump or anything Trump was saying, but he, you know, he still had that persona of coming from the outside and not being, you know, a servant of the establishment. And you know, I think the deep state definitely mismanaged, you know, that. They could have, you know, allowed the Democratic Party voters to have their vote and had Bernie Sanders in and, you know, tried to preempt him and not had Hillary. You know, she was just such a horrible candidate. You know, I can't think of anybody that could look at her personal or political career and in any way say that she was a good candidate for running the United States. I mean,
Brian, so, I know way too many people would disagree with you, and I even have friends that would say that she was a very good candidate and was way better than Trump or any other candidate.
Until you have about 5 minutes to, you know, really discuss it.
Oh, no. Some people are just impossible. But moving to another point, does really Trump have any allies in his establishment or in his presidency, in his office? Does he really have any allies left, or he's completely overwhelmed by the deep state?
Well, I think there's two levels here. First of all, him as a person. I think he's weak. I think he's short-sighted. And I think he's, as a politician, grossly incompetent. So that resulted in him losing. Believe me, I'm no fan of Bannon. I truly am not. And on General Flynn, I thought he was good on Russia. I thought he was horrible on China and totally irresponsible on Iran. But my taste doesn't matter. What matters is that when Trump came to the White House, it was pretty clear that Bannon and Flynn were his two main allies. He sacrificed them both. At which point, it becomes irrelevant, you know, if there are other people around him. Now, for instance, I think Rex Tillerson is for real and tries to do more or less what Trump promised. But the problem is that, first of all, the rumors he's going to resign because he can't even rein in the crazy U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley to the U.N., who speaks, you know, in the name of the United States. She's clearly a lunatic. and secondly, even if Tillerson got control of the State Department, which he doesn't, there's still the Pentagon and the CIA running their own foreign policies completely. So at that point, the entire issue of whether Trump has allies is becoming moot, because if you were an ally of Trump right now, you would be hunkering down and trying to keep a low profile, because they all got slaughtered. It's pretty clear. Now, of course, he does have allies. I mean, I think you could say, for instance, that the U.S. economy is roughly split between the financiers and the industrialists. Industrials want to produce something. The financiers just want to speculate. Clearly, Hillary and all the neocons and the deep state prefer the empire and the financiers as opposed to somebody who actually produces something in this country. But I don't think it really matters at this point, because the industries are all also under control of that deep state, which is a political agenda which is imposed very harshly here. You do not go against the deep state if you want to keep your position or if you want to, you know, be heard, particularly not in Congress, which is controlled completely. I mean, if there's two entities in this country which are absolutely controlled by the deep state and the main component of the deep state, which is the neocons, it's Congress and the media. And right now, those two are very powerful. They frighten everybody. And you know that you have to walk the party line if you want to survive. So basically, no, I would say Trump has absolutely nobody, largely to his own, by his own fault. He could have done, and he's not the first president, I would add. I mean, it's going to sound funny, but I would compare him very much with Barack Obama. When Barack Obama came into the White House, a lot of people, well, first of all, he was a charming man and a very articulate one, but a lot of people voted for him because of the slogan, you know, change you can believe in, and they really want to change again. Not necessarily because they carefully studied his political program and really wanted, you know, a specific policy from him, but they wanted true change. And that never happened. And I was wondering, I remember when Obama was elected, you know, how long he would last before he would even try to resist the deep state. And I thought he could do one thing that Trump could have done also, which is directly appeal to the American people over the heads of the media. And I don't mean by Twitter and 140 characters long tweets. I don't mean much. he could have appealed to the American people directly and said, you know what, I'm physically at risk. I'm trying to do things here, and everybody here in Washington is sabotaging me. Please come and help me. And I can promise you that for Obama, and even so more so for Trump, you would have over a million Americans downtown D.C., about half of them armed. And they would have tried to help the man, you know, because if that's a big thing. The Americans don't feel that he represents their interests. Mm-hmm. That's the other huge difference between him and Putin. If somebody were to attack Putin seriously in Russia, I can guarantee you would have a national uprising in his defense. And Putin knows that, and so do the Russian elites. The oligarchs have not completely disappeared. They're kept quiet and they stay out of politics. But the Putin haters and the Russian elites, most Russian elites still hate Putin, make no mistake about it. But they know that they cannot touch the man because the people will never allow that. This could have happened in the United States. I profoundly believe that. I know most of my neighbors here in downtown in Florida, if they felt that the president appeals for their physical presence in the streets to start draining the swamp, I think they would have jumped in their cars and gone. Unfortunately, it's again a huge disappointment. And again, he caved in. So his ultimate ally was the people, and he even lost that. And I don't believe the polls anyways, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to say how many points did he lose or win in the past, but I can tell you people are immensely disappointed. I won't put a figure on that, but people who truly believe Trump finally would do it are now disappointed.
And I believe that what you're saying is was done actually by President Erdogan in Turkey. Whenever he faced difficulties, he appealed to the people, to his voters and to his supporters, and they went on the streets. Whenever they tried to sabotage him, or even last year with the coup attempt, the moment it got really hot, he just went and publicly told his supporters, go on the streets and support me. And millions of people across Turkey started supporting him, went on the streets to support him. So I'm thinking that you're pointing at the same thing. Is it right?
Yes, exactly. The Erdogan, thank you for bringing up that example, is the perfect example of a man, if needed, you know, if you have that level of popularity, you tell people, I need you to help me free this country, and they'll walk out. They will go and help you.
And I believe that's the way one of the ways that the coup attempt last year actually failed. Because millions of his supporters took the streets to stop this madness in Turkey. Yep. And let's go to some specific questions that we want to cover today. And are the U.S. and Russia anyway collaborating in Syria? And if they do, why are they doing it? And what is the ultimate goal of both sides, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I would not describe the U.S. as a unitary actor, so I don't believe
this is a very good point, and I think that the audience should listen to this, that the U.S. is not acting as one unity. So please continue.
So from the Russian point of view, and there's actually something that began under Obama in the late part of his presidency. The Russian diplomats start using a Russian word, which is недоговороспособный. It's a long word. It means, literally, if you translate it word by word, it means unable to make an agreement or non-agreement capable. And they were complaining that, essentially, for instance, you remember Secretary Kerry was going to Moscow saying A, and then he was flying back to Washington, D.C. and saying non-A. The Americans were promising one thing and doing the other. At that point, the first complaints began that they were basically недоговороспособны, which means unable to even deliver on any kind of agreement. And that's exactly what we see today with the United States, because what happened under Obama just got worse. And it's kind of a natural process. This is normal. If you have the chief of the executive who's extremely weak for whatever reason, it could be because he's incompetent like Obama and weak, or because he's isolated and surrounded by people who betray him, like Trump. And the example for that statement is, if you cannot even talk to a foreign head of state without having the transcript of that conversation in the media, I mean, you can't operate anymore as a president. So there is no U.S. foreign policy in Syria. none. And therefore, the Russians are just looking at that in absolute dismay because they understand how stupid it is. But there's nothing they can do. There's nobody to talk to. They can talk, if you want, there's a level of people in the United States who are competent to talk to the Russians. It would be the CENTCOM commander or the, you know, the commander is actually involved in the Operation Syria, but they don't have the authority to take decisions. The authority rests with people who are not in command anymore. And then you have the parallel policies run by at least the CIA, the Pentagon, and the State Department on the Tillerson. Who do you talk to? They're clearly not bound. You know, the Americans say, we signed a ceasefire, and, you know, a couple of days later, cruise missiles start flying. So at that point, who do you want the Russians to work with? So, no, unfortunately, there is no collaboration because there's nobody to collaborate with. I mean, I know it sounds hard to believe, but I'm absolutely convinced of that.
No, I definitely think you're right. I mean, there's definitely no consensus at all in the federal government as far as foreign policy in Syria. You know, you can look at, you know, Kerry and Lavrov made agreements on a ceasefire in Syria, and a day later, within 24 hours, the Air Force was bombing Syrian troops in Deir ez-Zor for over an hour.
Yep.
And, you know, was that was that an attempt to derail a peace initiative? But, you know, there's definitely no consensus between the Department of Defense, the intelligence community, and the White House at all. And that was true for during the Obama administration, and it's true now during the Trump administration, for sure.
So what do you believe that is going to happen in the future? What's Syria's future in the next few months?
Well, I'm not a prophet, and it's extremely hard for me. I always have the same unsatisfactory reply, which is by training, I'm, you know, trained to try to understand what's called a rational actor. So if you make rational assumptions, most of the things that have happened over the past year or so would never have happened to begin with. So how can I possibly say what would happen in the next couple of months? I can tell you that at the minimal, what is my hopes are, it's the least bad situation. I think that basically the world, you know, has to move on. The U.S. is right now basically absent from the world stage, contrary to the images you see of the propaganda and machine, because they say, you know, the threats and North Korea. That's not policy. That's nonsense. That is PR. But in terms of responsible policy, the U.S. is now generally absent, and the rest of the world needs to move on. And for instance, in Syria, I think that Russia is going to basically act unilaterally within the constraints, the objective constraints that limit Russian action in Syria. The U.S. being absent is just one of the constraints. But if the Americans are not present to negotiate something with, well, the Russians will have to talk to everybody else, which is exactly what they're doing. They're talking to the Israelis, to the Iranians, to Hezbollah. They're talking to the so-called moderate or the good terrorists who now are become allies. They're talking to absolutely everybody, to the Turks, to the Kurds. And that is how foreign policy is done responsibly. You talk to everybody and you try to achieve a workable solution. And that's what they're doing. I hope they will continue doing it. Right now, Daesh, and I use that word very loosely. I don't like the semantic differences between al-Nusra, Daesh, al-Qaeda, and the rest of the bad terrorists, and basically, you know, assemble them under the word Daesh and describe them as Takfiris. I think they're on the weak side right now. They're clearly losing. There was a vapid and very unsuccessful U.S. attempt to actually invade Syria from the south, and it didn't work because they were hoping to cut off the Syrians from the border with Iraq, and that failed, so now they're withdrawing. I think the U.S. is basically done with Syria, threw in, for all practical purposes, you know, threw the towel and basically said whatever. But there's always the risk, again, of somebody crazy doing something truly stupid. I mean, when I saw the cruise missile attack that happened after the so-called chemical attacks, which obviously wasn't that, I couldn't believe my eyes. I couldn't have, for the life of me, I could not have imagined a more stupid action than this. Yet it happened. So tomorrow, you know, I have to say, I'm not trying to be cute. I think they're capable of absolutely anything. Mm-hmm. And I'm not capable of predicting how crazy they're capable of going. Same thing for the DPRK. There's constantly rumors of war. I mean, as a military analyst, I can tell you that's a non-starter. You cannot win a war with aircraft carriers and, you know, Japanese, South Korean help. I mean, whatever you achieve at the end is not called a victory. I can say this. It makes no sense. But do I completely exclude that some lunatic is actually going to order strikes in North Korea? I can't, because I distrust. I agree with the Russian assessment. Americans are not only neither, they're not capable of formulating a rational policy anymore. That's how scary it is for me.
And Brian, but we're at the same time, we're seeing that the U.S.-backed forces are besieging and are getting closer and closer to the center of Raqqa, which used to be the capital of ISIS. And it seems that the U.S. does have a policy on Syria. And what do you believe, Brian, is going to happen there after Raqqa probably falls? And is it actually going to fall?
Well, I agree with the Saker, and I've said it before. I think at this point, the United States has, you know, very few options at all in Syria. You know, they're not going to pull out. They're still going to be involved. And, you know, God knows what decisions will be made. But as far as Raqqa is concerned, I think it's, you know, what will happen if the Syrian Democratic Forces take Raqqa? You know, it's been a great distraction for them for the past few months. It's allowed the Syrian Arab Army to outflank them and move down the Euphrates and, you know, pretty much, you know, gain the initiative there in southern Syria. So it's kind of, it was like a focal point that, you know, it was like during the Napoleonic Wars, Genoa for the Austrians, you know, gave Napoleon a chance to work around them, or Stalingrad for Hitler. He focused so much on that city that he kind of lost focus of the greater, wider war. You know, I don't really see much changing if the SDF takes Raqqa. So what if the U.S. supports that operation? It's not really going to change, you know, things on the ground as far as the end result. So I really don't think the United States has any really good options in Syria. And, you know, like the Saker says, there's really an absence of not so much American leadership in, you know, dealing with these issues, but they're not even capable or willing to sit down with maybe one or two strong allies in the case of Syria or even in Korea and come up with a, you know, what's the best option here. They're totally, they're like they're bereft in a sea in a boat without oars. They have no direction. And, but like the Saker says, you never know, you know, somebody could do something crazy. If you look at North Korea, and the United States, with the amount of saber rattling and the brinksmanship that just keeps escalating and escalating, it's kind of crazy, you know. People, I talk to people here, and you know, my friends, and they're like, "Oh my God, you know, Kim Jong Il's gonna fire rockets at Guam, or you know, or nuke Guam." Like, you know, have you ever really thought what benefit could possibly come to the DPRK if they were to nuke Guam? I mean, it's game over. I mean, that's the last thing they're going to do. They're going to threaten to do it, but they're never going to do it. It's the least beneficial option for them. So, yeah, I think the United States is definitely, you know, lost its focus anywhere as far as foreign policy. They're not in control. And I think everybody sees it. Turkey, Russia, Iran, Syria, China, they're all making their own plans, and they're all working with whoever's willing to work with them to come up with a beneficial outcome. And that's just, you know, that's where we are today.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, of course you can. Please.
You mentioned the possibility of taking Raqqa, for instance. That is not a policy. I mean, that at most is a military objective, but military power cannot be used for the sake of using military power. A military operation is always done with this, or should at least be always done with a specific outcome in mind, in support of a specific policy. Let's assume, for instance, that the United States takes not only Raqqa, but takes whatever other territory we could take in Syria. And then what? What is, okay, you've done that, and then what? And that's where I say there's no U.S. policy. There is a presence. There might be even a military activity, and they might even take the decision to destroy this or that, or take this or that objective. But I don't. To me, this does not qualify as a policy. likewise in the DPRK. Let's assume something which I don't believe is reasonable, that you could strike by a combination of cruise missiles, even stealth aircraft, B-1 bombers, B-2 bombers, doesn't matter. Let's assume you can strike North Korea and very successfully even completely destroy all their supposed nuclear devices, which are not weapons yet. And then what? See, that's why to me this does not, there is a minimal, a specific level that has to be met before this qualifies as a foreign policy. Disarming North Korea by military means is not a policy. It could be a tool in support of a policy, maybe, but it's not a policy because they're going to fight back. And then what? How do you deal with the consequences of that? Of 500 artillery shells falling per minute, on Seoul. How do you deal with the South Korean reaction to that, and what it does to the system of U.S. islands in the Pacific Rim, etc.? You have to look at much more to qualify your actions as a policy. Erratic shooting with your gun is not a policy, and that's, I think, all we can expect. So that is why I'm saying there's no Syrian U.S. policy in Syria. There might be actions, but in my book, they don't qualify as a policy. I wanted to just explain why I say there's no policy in Syria.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have a question from the audience, which is very interesting. It's for both of you. From what you're saying, would you say that Kim Jong-un is more reasonable than the U.S. leaders then?
I don't know. I'm not a psychiatrist. my gut feeling is to say that Trump and he deserve each other.
Just from what they're saying and what they're doing from their actions, what do you think?
Well, no, I would not. I cannot give an endorsement to the mental state of the Korean leaders, but I would add that if you set aside the rhetoric, I think they have a very legitimate goal, which is to survive. Mm-hmm. And that is not something irrational. They were willing to talk to the United States in the past, where they were even willing to consider disarmament option against guarantees. So I would feel much more comfortable if the Chinese ran, the DPRK, and that would, get a much better interlocutor. I'm not of a good opinion of the political leadership in North Korea, but I don't find them nearly as crazy as, frankly, what I hear coming out of the White House.
And Brian?
Well, I think the government of the DPRK is, it's a totalitarian regime that, heavily relies on the military and the cult of personality. I think a lot of the rhetoric is just merely rhetoric. They don't want a shooting war, for sure. They've always, the current leader's father was the same way. They like to use this rhetoric to, kind of force people to the negotiating table. They don't want a shooting war. But they have to make it look like they're so unpredictable and they're so ready to go to war that, the only option is to sit down and talk. So I don't think that they're, regardless of the bluster coming out of Pyongyang, that they want a shooting war at all.
I agree.
That's not what they want. And, if you look at the activities of the U.S. government over the past 50 years and, how many countries we've invaded or bombed or, torn apart in some way, how rational is the decision-making process in Washington? I think, the Saker said, I think if maybe Kim Jong-il and Trump could sit down over some cocktails, they'd probably get along really well. Who knows?
I would add, just imagine looking at what happened to Gaddafi. And you're sitting looking at that from the point of view of the North Koreans. You look at that kind of action, you go, maybe we really are doing the right thing by keeping, nuclear weapon program running. I mean, they're given exactly zero incentive to behave by anybody. I'm appalled by that. And again,
definitely.
Part of it is that the solution is completely obvious to everybody. It's just the United States, has embarked for many years in this heroic effort to not see the obvious solution. And that's what I find irrational. I mean, is it a good thing to corner a country like North Korea. I think it's a terrible idea.
And if I can add to this and ask you, I remember one of the quotes from Vladimir Putin, and he said that if the fight is inevitable, always hit first. Do you think that North Korea could hit first if it's threatened with, not just threatened, but knows that the war is inevitable?
No, I don't think you should take that quote and apply to the situation in North Korea. North Korea would, even if they believe that they're preempting, which is what Putin was referring to, for clear political motives, they absolutely have to write out the initial attack. Recently, there was an article in China, I think in the China Daily, I'm not sure, which clearly spelled out that the Chinese would not support the DPRK if it attacks the United States, but if the United States attacks the DPRK, then China would take action to not allow that from happening.
So it's something similar, sorry for interrupting, so it's something similar to the U.S. position during World War II when they said that they are not going to support Stalin if Stalin attacks Germany, but if Germany attacks the Soviet Union, then they will support the USSR.
No, I don't think examples from World War II apply to that situation. We're dealing with a very unique situation, the Korean Peninsula. The asymmetry between, say, the United States and the North Koreans is such that it cannot be compared with any other situation. The North Koreans are in such an inferior position in terms of overall strength that their strategy needs to be very carefully and uniquely crafted to that reality. And the first, I completely agree with what was said. The last thing they want is a shooting war. And if that ever happens, they absolutely have to do everything in their power to make clear that they were first attacked. And then only can they do anything else. But that is absolutely overwhelming priority for them. So I don't think they would even to preempt. And finally, they don't really have the means to preempt the United States. Because the kind of assets that would be brought into hitting, what Putin was referring to is, for instance, a situation similar to the one that Saddam Hussein faced when he lets the Americans make a huge buildup in Saudi Arabia before letting them attack. This is a situation where military strategy compels you to attack first to prevent that buildup. And that buildup in Saudi Arabia was within reach of the Iraqi armored units. But even if the North Koreans wanted to preempt the United States, what are they going to do? They don't have the means whatsoever of substantially striking the U.S. military, which would be by definition of preemption.
Brian, what is your take on this?
I agree 100%. I said that's the last thing that the DPRK is going to do. And, they would have to allow the United States or South Korea and Japan and the United States attack first because, they would have to appear as the victim. You know, right now, at least the Western mass media has portrayed them as the evil villain. So why would they ever attack first? Number one, they have no hopes of winning. And number two, it shores up that villain persona that the United States would use to justify its retaliation. And I think China very wisely kind of took it out of the hands of the leadership in Pyongyang and the United States, really, by saying, if you are attacked first, we will support you and we will prevent your regime change in the Korean Peninsula. But if you attack first, we're not going to help you. So, they very wisely stepped in and kind of laid that out there for both parties.
I entirely agree.
And we have a question from the audience. And do you see the DPRK anytime soon sign any kind of international nuclear agreement?
A nuclear agreement with the DPRK would be primarily a nuclear agreement with the United States. The United States right now are categorically opposed to providing any kind of guarantees. Part of the stupid political thing about appearing weak. I mean, just imagine if Trump decided to get a reasonable deal, a good deal for the United States working with North Korea, he would be immediately accused of being weak and, you know, a Putin agent again. So remove the United States from the possibility of an international agreement, and it makes it meaningless. Makes no sense, because the only everybody knows where the problem is. Russia and China don't like the DPRK being armed with nukes. They don't particularly like Kim Jong-un. They are not happy with the situation, but there's no real crisis. They can manage that. The only crisis is between the United States and North Korea. And any agreement would be have to be between those two, and those, and the United States will never accept that. Therefore, the question is completely hypothetical.
And let's move to some other issues that we can discuss, and let's move more to Russia and what's going on there. We're seeing that next year in March are going to be the presidential elections. Do you think that Putin is going to run for president for the fourth time because he has this opportunity based on the constitution? Or do you think that the internal powers in Russia are going to choose another person?
Again, I'm not a prophet, but I sure hope he will run again. I think he will run again. And I think that there are basically only two internal powers in Russia. Could call them the supporters of Putin, which don't have a better candidate, and the opponents of Putin, which I call the Atlantic integrationists, who would be a disaster for Russia. So I predict that he will run. I think he'll win with no problem. But my God, if he for some reason was pushed or had to not run, it would be extraordinarily bad for Russia and highly destabilizing. So I sure hope he runs.
How do you see both of you? I want to see, because you're both military experts, and I want to hear your opinion on the possibilities of another war in Ukraine, and how are the US and Russia going to negotiate on the future of Ukraine? Brian, you can start first.
You want to go? Maybe you want to start first?
Sure, I'll give it a try. As far as the stalemate in the Ukraine right now, I mean, the United States definitely just recently, I think it was this week, they made an announcement that they're building a naval facility in the Ukraine. So they're definitely there to stay. As far as the confrontation between the Donbass regions and the Kiev regime becoming a shooting war again, I mean, it's really a shooting war every day, really. I mean, a lot of people in the West don't understand what's going on there. But as far as becoming a full-fledged war again, it's always in the cards. I mean, when you have leadership like we've talked about in both the United States and in Kiev, Poroshenko's got a very he's got some strange bedfellows in his government there, you know, the neo-Nazis and nationalists and a whole host of different factions there that he's trying to keep together and supporting his presidency. A lot of those factions want a war. And, if the United States continues their support as far as militarily with intelligence and non-lethal and now lethal weapon systems, and they're building bases in the Ukraine, I don't see it de-escalating anytime soon. I'm sure there's a lot of hawkish forces within the Russian administration that have been from the start putting a lot of pressure on Putin's administration to do more as far as military action in the Ukraine. But it's just really hard to tell. You know, it's really hard to tell. If you would have asked me 5 years ago that we would be looking at, you know, a crisis in the Ukraine like this, or the DPRK possibly going to a nuclear conflict there, I would have been, you're crazy. But, you know, you just never know. So I'd like to think that we won't have another series of conflicts there in the Ukraine where there's, you know, full-fledged war. But, you know, I just the United States has kind of thrown their cards on the table there, and they're behind the illegitimate government in my eyes in Kiev. So, I really don't know.
Saker.
My feeling is the United States right now is not really focusing on the Ukraine, which is the least bad news possible, because time is very much on Russia's side and against the junta in Kiev. So anything that is not a war and that prolongs it at this point is better than the alternative. A hot war would be obviously worse. I don't see meaningful American actions right now. Again, I don't see a policy. And somehow being so involved with other threats left and right, including Venezuela, the DPRK, Iran, etc., I hope the United States will basically do nothing. This is my best. It's a very pessimistic scenario considering how really it should be solved. And it, again, the solution are not that outlandishly complicated. But frankly, the alternative being a hot war, my hope is that it stays simmering as a tepid war as it is right now. And I don't see signs of an imminent escalation. The Ukrainians have been beat up very, very badly twice. Now, it's debatable whether they have recovered or not. I hear different things about it. I don't have the kind of access to tell it either way. But even if, say, the Ukrainian side got stronger, there is north wind and there is, you know, the Vayentorg, Russia will not let the Donbass be conquered. Mm-hmm. So I think they would like to do it, but they're very reluctant at the same time because they know the risks they would be taking are huge. So basically, if I had to predict something, I would see a stalemate and more of the same until something substantially changes in the United States. I mean, the key thing right now is what's happening here. Everything else is sort of in a semi-frozen situation because of that.
And we actually have another question for you to predict on, as from the audience. So the question is, and I think that you'll be able to kind of answer it. Will the Ukrainian economy and regime survive next year? And what are the chances of the problem to disappear by itself just because of the regime failing?
Well, remember that, you know, people have been waiting for the collapse of the Ukraine for a very long time. And at least externally, the signs are not here. I would say it has collapsed already. If we take the definitions of Dmitry Orlov of the stages of collapse, the Ukraine has been collapsed already a long time. It's an absolutely non-viable state. The economy is in worse than shambles. But, you know, Somalia also survived. I remember Argentina during the crisis. I mean, as a country, the Ukraine is already dysfunctional, essentially dead. That does not necessarily result in a regime change. And a regime change in a crisis as bad as what's taking now could be a very bad thing. Remember, somewhere the devil you know is better than the one you don't. Because if you look at who might replace Poroshenko, that can be very scary too. So I would say, yes, the Ukraine will survive externally as a territory, as an officially recognized state with borders, with a population, etc. As a country, as a viable country, has been already dead for a while.
What do you think then of the Mauer Russia project? I saw that you have some information on it on your website, but can you explain a little bit on what you're thinking of the Mauer Russia project?
If we're talking about a long-term, we have to look at, and that's a fascinating topic, you know, what happens the day after this ends? My personal belief is the Ukraine as a state within its border today is not viable and will break up. I think it's the only sensible solution. At that point, the next question is, well, what happens to the Donetsk and Lugansk republics? At the very least, they got to unite and obtain some kind of status, and they could be united under the name Belarusia. Why not? I think the labels matter less than what can actually happen on the ground. Right now, there is no real Belarusia. There is a non-viable entity, even if it's a surviving one. But as it is right now, those two republics are not a viable entity. The war needs to be stopped for even be considering a viable entity. So there are a lot of things need to happen. But if somewhere down the line, yes, I think there will be... I can say for sure I don't think they'll ever return really to the Ukraine. I think that's gone. I don't see any way of them other than conquering Kiev. that's the only way for them to achieve a unitary status for them. And that's probably not going to happen either, because really the east of Ukraine is very different from the center or from the west. Again, it's not a unitary state. So once the breakup happens, yeah, probably something of a Malorossia kind will probably happen. I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. And we have a question from the audience, and it's again for both of you. And it's kind of a question and kind of a statement. And this person says, perhaps Russia is not much of a rebel, in quotes, against the world order as they advertise themselves to be. What do you think?
So I categorically disagree with that, most emphatically. And again, we can judge, we don't have to go in the abstract, we look by their actions. Right now today, Russia is the only country that has a worldwide reach and relevance and that openly challenges the hegemony of the Anglo-Zionist empire. There is Iran out there that does the same thing, has been doing it for years, but they just don't have the size to do that. And there is China, which has the means, but is being very careful, and rightfully so. I think the Chinese have been very wise. Russia didn't choose that situation. Russia initially wanted to be part of the international system, particularly, certainly, and it was completely a U.S. colony during Yeltsin, and it certainly wanted to integrate with you know, NATO and the U.S. Under the Medvedev governments. What happens under Putin is different. I think there is an open civilizational challenge on the part of Russia, which goes way beyond just political statements. It's social statements. It's religious statements. It's moral statements. It's spiritual statements. It's a clear vision of a world which is multipolar and rejects the hegemony of one. It's a world where law, international law, has to be respected. And not contemptuously ignored. So I think Russia is actually the only country in the world that presents a full spectrum resistance to the empire. So I categorically disagree. I couldn't disagree more with that statement.
And Brian, do you believe this? And what do you think is China's position in the new order? Even if we don't get the new, even if we don't set a label to the so-called New World Order as a crazy conspiracy, but just as world order. What do you think is China's position there? And are there going to be the new U.S. as the new state which fully controls the other side of the world?
Well, firstly, I'd like to agree with what the Saker said about Russia. I mean, I agree 100%. You know, they're like the, I kind of see them as like the great hope. You know, they have a very rational foreign policy view and you know where they want the world to go here. You know, they want a multipolar world. They're working towards that. Everything that they've done as far as foreign policy is all about stability and not having conflicts, about, you know, all nations following an agreed to international system of laws. And I think that's been a great influence on the world as a whole. And I hope it continues. As far as China, you know, China has its own interests. They're, you know, they're a rising global power. And I think if you look at China's history, and also if you look at Russia's history, if you look at China's history, they're not an expansionist power. They never have been. They've always been very powerful, both militarily, culturally, academically, militarily, always powerful. But they look inwardly. You know, they do things internationally. They work with international partners, and they come up with global partnerships that benefit them, and often in the long run benefit their partners. And China is definitely looking to, if anything, expand economically. You know, they have to build a strong military in order to support and defend their economic expansion. So I don't think you know, we should look at China as supplanting the United States as the global superpower. I don't think that's their intention. They have a totally different viewpoint on, you know, where they want to go in the world, you know, than the United States does. And I think Russia realizes that, and that's why Russia is willing to work with them on so many things as a partner, because China and Russia, I think, both desire a unipolar world. Neither one of those countries desires to be an empire that controls everything like the United States has tried to do for the past 50, 60, 70 years. It's just, it's not the desire of either one of those countries.
And if I can make, can I add something here?
Yeah, of course.
I think I want to stress the importance of what Brian just said. And the question that you ask, you know, will China become the next U.S., has as an assumption that that's something desirable. And I really think, I profoundly believe, I mean, for Russia, I know for a fact, and China, I suppose, is the same thing. I think there comes an awareness at a specific historical moment in time in a country and a nation where it goes, empires are bad for us. We don't want to be an empire anymore. And I think it's a big wisdom. Imperialism is disastrous for the hosts, always. And in Russia, for instance, I follow Russian politics extremely closely. I can tell you there is no imperialist constituency. There is no party that advocates it. None. Simply doesn't. There are more people pro-U.S., which I consider to be somewhere between maybe 2 and 5% of the population, than pro-empire. If anything, the Russians are isolationist, or they want to be within our border, yes.
But what do you think of, I'm sorry for interrupting, but for Russia, what do you think of Zhirinovsky or the military industry? Don't you think that they have some imperial minds?
None whatsoever. First of all, Zhirinovsky, you have to understand the character. He's a guy who is essentially paid to say a lot of very good and smart things that nobody else says, and you know, to see how it reacts, and a lot of absolutely insane nonsense. But nobody, you have to understand, first of all, political powers, political parties in Russia don't really matter. It's a complicated topic. I don't think we can go into it right now. But the opposition to Putin is not in the Duma or in the political parties; it's inside the state. Russia is sort of a strange society with an external veneer of democracy, but profoundly it's a very different kind of society. And if you look at when you mentioned the military-industrial complex in Russia, that would be a real actor. But that actor does not need war at all to do well. It's exporting superbly worldwide. It's pulling the Russian economy. They're doing fine. And a lot of people there also have remember the war, are well-read, and realize it would be a disaster for Russia. So, no, I truly believe that there's no constituency in Russia whatsoever. There's a constituency for a strong country, yes. One that is sovereign, that is not going to be attacked again like it happened during World War II, and is largely fed up with Western interventionism. But to become an empire, none whatsoever. And I think it's the same case in China. These countries simply understood that this is not smart. For instance, their way of upholding international law is not out of some deep moral sense of wanting to be, you know, ethically pure. It's because they realize it's in their favor. I think the anti-imperialist stance of these two countries comes straight out of a rational, pragmatic analysis of national interest and not out of ideology.
Mm-hmm. And we touched on the international law topic. And Brian, I want to ask you, because we have a question from the audience, what will be the U.S. and the UN position on Yemen because of what's happening there, and the body count of children killed is just growing and growing every single day?
I really don't see it changing. I mean, I think Desaker talked about our wonderful representative in the UN, our ambassador, Nikki Haley. I mean, you might as well have taken John Bolton and shaved his ridiculous mustache and put a black wig on him and a dress and high heels. I mean,
yeah,
you know, she's cut from the same cloth. You know, I don't see any changes there. I mean, Saudi Arabia and their allies have been bombing Yemen and subjecting the civilian population there to unbelievable depravities for years now. And it's been horrible for years. Is there going to be a consensus that's going to go against the United States and the UN in Yemen, of all places? I don't see it happening. I mean, I would love to see it happen. I would love to see that conflict stop tomorrow. I would love to see international support for a ceasefire there and a return to, let the Yemeni people decide their own fate, which they were doing, you know, before the Saudis decided to intervene. And I don't see any big push in the UN against the will of the United States and the Saudis and their allies to change that situation, unfortunately.
See, the thing is that, and what's so crucial in the situation right now is that every time, every question we've touched so far, the issue is, it's not going to change. And why isn't it going to change? Because right now the United States are busy imploding and fighting internally. And as long as that continues, there's not going to be any change. So everything is essentially paralyzed. There's an almost worldwide stasis. And right now the only thing that could break that stasis is a hot war, which is not a very good perspective. And so if a hard war, God willing, does not happen, and the stasis will continue until something else happens, and what that something else might be can only start coalescing and crystallizing itself out of a resolution of the current conflict inside the United States, which I don't see resolving anytime soon. So this is why I think both me and Brian are saying, nah, not much change, nah, not going to happen, because we just don't see, you cannot, the United States is powerful enough that you can't really go against them. You can ignore them, you can actually resist them to a certain degree, but to get actually something constructive happening is very hard, just because of, for instance, the U.S. power in the United Nations. If the United States suddenly disappeared, you know, by a magic wand or lost its membership in the U.N., a lot of things could happen. But as long as a country that's essentially been lobotomized right now, in terms of literally, in terms of the people that are at the top and the degree of paralysis that you have at the top, there is no policy. Who would be in charge of taking a decision on Yemen and maybe deciding on an agreement? Nobody. It's really depressing.
And I see a question. I'm looking at the live stream right now, and there is a question, and it's towards the Saker. Do you think that Russia could move to Yemen after Syria? Focus on Yemen.
No, I don't. You have to understand Russia is not an anti-U.S. Russia is not going to start involving itself the way Soviet Union did it all over Africa. There's many reasons for that. You've probably heard that the Russian defense budget is, according to some, depends how you calculate it, about a tenth of the U.S. one. Others say it's even smaller. Russian military strategy basically says that Russia has to keep control and prevail within 1,000 kilometers of the Russian borders. It's never been formulated like that, but that's essentially what it means. You can speak of operational depth. Russia is already overextended in Syria and too far. That was a fluke case. They did something very, very refined and very complicated. But even that is not a real military intervention. The Russians did not really intervene militarily in Syria like they did in Afghanistan, or they did in the past in Angola or other parts of the world. And I don't see them having... They simply don't have the capabilities to get involved in places like Yemen. No, I don't see that happening. And politically, it would be impossible, by the way. When Putin ordered the Russian aerospace forces to move into Syria, everybody got really very, very tense immediately, including myself, I have to confess. I was very concerned about that move. And he explained very specifically that it's something limited in time, limited in scope, limited in nature, and that it was done for clear Russian national security objectives, which is to protect the southern borders of Russia, specifically Caucasus and Central Asia. So there's no way he can go to the Russian people and say, we're going to send our forces into Yemen. Mm-hmm. Even he, with his popularity, cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. And we have a question from the audience, and both of you, I will kindly ask you for with your military background, because it's a very close question to me. We have a very strong Balkan audience from the Balkans, and there is a question, because the Balkans are always heating up whenever the administration in the U.S. Changes, and we see that Serbia right now is basically besieged from all sides by countries which are right around vassals of the U.S. Do you see what would happen if Serbia tries to take back control of, let's say, Kosovo or Metohija with its army, and how would NATO react in this case?
Brian?
Well, I mean, the United States has been working on fragmenting the Balkans and making them friendly to NATO, and obviously NATO stands for the interests of the United States for decades now. You know, they've Balkanized the Balkans very well, And you know, the Balkans, there's so many different ethnic groups and cultures and cultural identities and histories there that are that intermingle and cross borders. And it's kind of, you know, Ukraine has a similar history as far as, you know, is Ukraine really a state, or is it, you know, a confluence of states over time? And, you know, if Serbia, you know, things seem to be heating up between Serbia and Kosovo, and, you know, there seems to be some groups in Kosovo, some radical groups or insurgent groups that seem to be making some moves as if they're preparing for something. You know, the Serbian Department of Defense and their intelligence is aware of this. Serbia is going to do what it has to do to defend its national security. Is the United States going to use NATO and the United Nations again, like they did in the past, to attack Serbia?
Possibly. Because NATO doesn't really have that much forces around Serbia, except for a few bases there. What do you think could happen, Desaker, when it comes to Serbia? Because if they want to protect their national interests, that would definitely causing military conflict there.
Well, first of all, right now you mentioned that the Serbia is surrounded by NATO. I don't think maybe you said colonies or
vassals.
But so is Serbia. Serbia is now de facto an occupied territory by NATO. So with that kind of government that they have right now in Serbia, which, you know, at best would be something similar to what Russia had in the 90s. I don't expect them to be particularly creative or dynamic in terms of defending their national interests. Secondly, you say that the U.S. doesn't have much forces around Serbia, but it has more than enough to deal with Serbia right now. And forces can be brought in rapidly. They can hit from afar. So right now, I think Serbia has to prepare for a long period of occupation by the empire. Only when the empire collapses can Serbia start reasserting her national rights. And I absolutely unequivocally consider Kosovo as part of Serbia. And I think that territory, by all any standard, should be part of a unitary Serbian state, as I consider Montenegro and Bosnia, by the way, at least the Serbian part of Bosnia. I think that what was done to the Serbian people is absolutely outrageous. But to right that wrong, a long time will have to pass before a national liberation can make that happen, because right now it's enforced from above. So Serbia can deal with her neighbors. She can't deal with an empire, not on her own. And the Russians are not coming, neither can they. So the balance of power is overwhelmingly against them, unfortunately, right now. So it's a matter of patience and playing it in the long run.
And I just wanted to add a few things, because I just have a lot of information when it comes to this. Right now, just for the audience sake, in Kosovo right now, there is a huge military base called Bomstil.
Camp Bomstil.
Yes, yeah. Camp Bomstil. And the U.S. forces are there, NATO forces are there, and they're actually training a lot of people from Kosovo. And they're sending them to British military schools, and they're sending them for free. So you don't have to pay anything. The people of Kosovo aren't getting, they're not paying anything for this. And actually, if you enroll in that army, and if you serve more than 5 or 7 years there, you're getting a lot of money, and you're getting actually another education outside of your military one. So they're basically paying for mercenaries there. And these mercenaries can be used in a potential war against Serbia. So that was just my take on this. And I wanted to move to another question that we had. Is there hypothetically a chance of a coup d'etat attempt in the U.S.? And what would happen if it happens? Brian, you can take first.
All right.
Well, anything's possible, you know. I think that, like the Saker said, I think Trump has been, for all intents and purposes, at least from what I can see now, relatively neutered. You know, he's surrounded himself by those in the establishment, holdovers from the Obama administration or holdovers from the Bush administration, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, if he really pushes the envelope and decides to, you know, go his own way and pushes hard against the deep state, of course there could be a coup. You know, what form that coup is going to take, you know, I don't know. But, I mean, unless you live in the United States, like, you know, the Saker said, I mean, you know, we're at this point of in the American empire where we're at like a boiling point. You know, there's so much polarization within the country as far as people's political views and, you know, even the American culture, you know, that you have, a very a different culture within the cities that heavily vote Democratic and pretty much everywhere else in the country that would be more conservative or I would say libertarian in a lot of ways, that, you know, there's almost like a, you can just feel it. There's in the atmosphere, it's we need a change. Something's going to happen in the United States because we can't keep going on the way we are now. You know, the government's not functioning correctly. We have no foreign policy. The deep state has shown its face. The American people have seen it. They don't like it. They've never liked it. Could there be a coup? Of course. I would not put anything past the deep state. The nature of it, I don't know. But there's definitely, you know, powerful forces at work in the United States, and things have to change. We can't stay on the same course. So, you know, I wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibility.
Saker.
I, first of all, agree with everything Brian said. I would just add one more thing. There is a big difference between the United States and, say, the Soviet Union in 1991. The Soviet state was fairly centralized. The United States has a very strong regional feel to it, which people who don't live here don't really see. But the states, amongst the states, there are very big differences, and people have strong local loyalties, and they're very diverse in terms of political views. It's correct. It's the cities versus the more rural areas. It's also, I would argue, you know, the Northeast versus the Southeast versus the South, the Southwest, the Center, the Northwest, are different groups. And for anybody contemplating a coup, that is a major headache, because if I do believe that in theory, I don't see it likely, and I will explain why I don't see it. I think the deep state will avoid acting overtly in a coup fashion as much as possible. But one of the reasons why I think that keeps them back from trying something like this is that I am not at all convinced that the federal government can assert its authority over the states in any semi-easy way. There could be a local resistance. It's a long topic of how, but I really think there's going to be a concern that certain parts of the country are just not going to obey. And I think that is a powerful deterrent against an overt coup. So a covert coup, which is essentially what happened with Trump. I mean, if you have one guy elected on a specific program and then he's prevented from acting and he's essentially neutered, I call that a coup. I think a coup has already happened against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But an overt one with, you know, uniformed personnel and armor in the streets would result in a backlash that's totally unpredictable, that could truly become catastrophic. Because one thing really is true, the American people are fed up. There's a lot of pent-up anger here, a lot of despair, too. The people, one last thing I want to say about the U.S., people say that, you know, communism fell in Russia in 1991, which is not true. The Soviet system fell. But some people maintain their communist ideas. Well, it's the same thing here. A lot of Americans feel patriotic, feel very strongly about the values that founded this country, about the principles it's supposed to stand for, and that makes them actually more anti-federal governments than pro. And these values are still here. And I think people, if you push them hard enough, actually, I think they could fight for it. But they need something. What's needed is a trigger. And that trigger is absent right now because of the propaganda system and because right now the overwhelming force is on the state side. You know, the uniformed cops, like they look like military, etc. So they're scared, and the overwhelming force is on the side of the federal government. But that could change if there was an overt political crisis.
And Saker, I just want to ask you, because we're almost reaching an hour and a half into the live program, do you have more time, or we should have one or two more questions and come to an end?
I could do another 20 minutes would be my limit, if that's okay with you.
So let's just have two or three more general questions and move to an end. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
And then right away, I'm going to move to another question that we had. And the person says, I have a question. Trump has surrounded himself with three generals and wants to use them to gain power. What happens if one of those generals take over instead?
Brian?
I don't see that happening. I mean, I think that would be such a controversial move that, like the Saker said, it would finally flip that trigger, that hair trigger that seems to exist in the American populace. The United States culturally, historically, is I don't think the overwhelming majority of the populace would tolerate a what many would see as a military dictatorship taking control in the White House. I think it's been a mistake. In many ways, the certain generals that Trump has chosen to participate in his administration. I mean, McMaster is a protege of Petraeus, and he should have seen him as a an enemy from the start. He's an Asper, a viper, crawling around in his bed. His recent changes with, I think it's General Kelly, and any of the other military members or prior military members of administration, they're not those military leaders that are opposed to the foreign policy of the past 20 years, and they're not opposed to the deep state. They are beholden to it. Do I think that one of those generals is going to take control? No, I think the vice president. I often wonder why Trump chose Pence as his vice president, because he's such an obvious.
Do you believe that Trump chose him?
Oh, well, he obviously he had to sign off on it. So yes, he approved it. Were there strong forces within the Republican Party that were kind of, forcing Pence on him as a running mate, kind of like Reagan was forced to take Bush? Of course. But in the end, at the end of the day, he chose to pick Pence, and I think he did that to kind of, appease members of the Republican establishment and to, appease certain members of the Republican conservative voting bloc. Of course, I don't really trust Pence. I think if Trump was removed, Pence will be more than happy to take the role of president. But do I see an overt coup where a military general takes control? No, I think that would be a disaster.
I completely agree with that. The only coup that the people would tolerate here would be one aimed at draining the swamp, but that's not happening, unfortunately. An overt coup that would actually, blatantly go against the U.S. Constitution would result, I think, in a huge backlash. And also keep in mind, American generals are mostly political people. They're not fighting people. You'll find most real experts and military specialists in the States in the rank of colonel or below.
Very true, very true.
So it's a different ecosystem. Once you become a general, particularly an influential one, you get co-opted by the state. You become very much a loyal product of that state, no matter how much they can call you a mad dog and try to give you this, this romantic view of a war fighting man. It's all nonsense. The real war fighters don't rise. In my experience, very few of them would rise above the rank of colonel and certainly not brigadier. So the kind of people that would do that are already essentially in power. The deep state is in power now. Why would they do a coup against itself?
And we have a question from the audience that he asked a few times. And what does the Saker think of the U.S. trying to break the INF treaty? How would Russia deal with this? It's about the International Agreement on Nuclear Weapons.
You mean the intermediate nuclear forces?
Yep.
Yeah. Look, at this point, I don't think it's going to have a major consequence because essentially all form of collaboration, or agreements are essentially broken. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. I don't think it's going to have, this is all political. Militarily speaking, the West does not have the means to attack Russia right now anymore. This is finished in terms of a possibility to do that. And in terms of escalation, well, Russia always responds mostly in an asymmetrical way and very creatively. I think they already made the assumption that intermediate nuclear weapons might be deployed. It doesn't make that much of a difference for Russia anymore.
And Brian actually had a pretty nice analysis on this. Can you touch a little bit upon it?
No, I agree. And I really don't think that Russia benefited really in very real terms from the INF treaty. You know,
agreed.
I mean, the United States is, far away. And, as far as intermediate range nuclear weapons, they have them on submarines, and the INF treaty allows that. They have them on ships, which allows that. And the United States military, their navy's, very powerful. So, those intermediate range nuclear missiles were well within range of Russia in light of the U.S. naval power. If anything, it kind of, tied Russia's hands a little bit in that they couldn't have, those same missiles land-based. But I think if that treaty were to, for all intents and purposes, go away, that Russia is not really going to be hampered by that. I'm sure they've spent, ever since the INF treaty was enacted, they've made the national defense decisions they've had to make to, allow for it. And so I don't see, much of a change for Russia as far as, if the INF treaty goes away. I think they'll be fine.
If anything, what's really happening right now, not much discussed, is that the Russians are deploying in large quantities strategic cruise missiles, conventional or potentially nuclear armed, and they could threaten both coasts of the United States in very many fashions, which essentially, that is the counter, if you want. If the Americans, the Americans are almost catching up, because that's the reality that's going to shape now. Is that Russian conventional cruise missiles, sea launched, but also launched from containers on commercial ships or merchant navy ships, could start threatening the United States. And most, if you look at the way the population are separated, Russia is pretty evenly populated, whereas the United States is the two coasts. And the two coasts are already within conventional strike ability of Russia, and of course nuclear too. Mm-hmm. So that would be, if you wanted to respond to that specific intermediate range threats, that would be already present.
Okay, and we're having the last question towards you two, and I really want to get your opinion on this because we're getting almost so many different opinions on this. And what's going on in the U.S. economy? What's going on there? Trump is saying that he's getting more and more jobs back, that he's cutting on the debt. But is this really a little bit of internal propaganda, or he's really doing something good for the American economy? Is he really transforming the economy? Saker, I'm...
Right, I think you're better qualified than
okay.
I am, probably.
Well, I mean, how much can one man and how much can the president really influence the economic situation in the United States? I mean, they really don't have much influence there, I mean, for a long time, the U.S. economy has been in a horrible state. I mean, if you look at our debt to GDP ratio, it's like 105% at least. Any nation that's that in debt, can't. Continue for long that way. And the only way we do it is because we have the printing press, basically. We have the world's reserve currency, and we can print money to our heart's content. And, all the other countries need to use the dollar for different international transactions, which is starting to slowly change. And I think that, that's going to, in the next decade, there's going to be a change there, as far as we're not going to be able to keep that printing press going. I think that Trump definitely has enemies within the Federal Reserve System, which is not federal. It's it's a group of private banks that they've started talking about raising interest rates to slow down what they see as a, you know, a, I don't know, an economy that's running a recovery too fast. So, no, I don't think Trump is really responsible for the any sort of economic recovery, if it even exists. I don't, that's a matter of semantics. It doesn't really exist. There's no, you know, huge recovery. I mean, we're so far in debt that, you know, adding 200,000 jobs last month or last quarter's just, it's really meaningless. You know, our monetary policy is so out of the realm of, you know, reason that Trump's not going to be able to change it himself. You know, there's so many factors that have to change. I mean, we have no manufacturing base in the United States anymore. We've offshored all the manufacturing. That's been going on for a long time. You know, the United States used to be, as it grew into a power, it was a manufacturing powerhouse. There was a real economy. Now, what we have now, services. I mean, we're a service-based economy. You have young kids getting out of college now with a, you know, a master's degree that are working as a barista at Starbucks. That's their only hope of a job. So, no, I don't think Trump is changing our economic situation anytime soon.
Well, I think Brian gave a much better answer than I could ever dream of giving. I'll give you a very simple one. My friends who, as a couple, work four jobs, both of them have two jobs, both for minimal wage, are still working their four jobs and barely making ends meet with no health care, no savings. And they're still at it. It hasn't changed. So that's my answer.
On this note, we're going to end the discussion. And I want to thank our friend, the Saker, for joining us today. I hope to have you in the future to discuss more topics and answer more questions from the audience. I also want to thank Brian for joining us today as well. And I'm just going to make a few announcements that we are going to have our next live stream just next week, again on Saturday on the 90th. Of August, and that we are working on two long videos, one about the popular mobilization units and another video about China's military capabilities. But in order for you to watch those videos and to continue and to continue our project and have more videos like this, please support our project. Please donate now, because we've collected only 19% of our minimal budget, and it's almost half of the month has been gone. So please donate now if you want to have more live streams, if you want to have more videos. You know that South Front is almost completely volunteer project, and we are not funded by any governments or any corporations. So please support our project. It's your way of fighting in the information war. It is your way of supporting independent projects like our and the Saker. So please support us. Please support the Saker. He will give you a few ways of supporting his project as well. And please do that, because if you want to counter in any way what's going on currently by the governments and by the corporations, it's by us, by supporting projects like ours. And please, Saker, tell us how our audience today can be of help to you.
I think what your audience can do to help me is to fund you, because what you're doing is absolutely unique. I think I've been following you pretty much since the beginning. I truly want to express my profound gratitude and admiration to all the people of South Front. What you're doing is very precious and important. I think your audience is way bigger than even what can be estimated. And I use your products every day, literally. I run your videos every day, and they provide something which nobody else provides. So I completely want to support that. And I hope that every person who enjoyed this broadcast will donate as much as you can possibly, guys. Help South Front. We need them badly, because they're fighting the information war. So my total complete support for them is what I ask for all of you.
Thank you, Saker. Thank you for your words. And please go to the Saker's website, read some of his analysis, read what he's posting. It's very interesting. He has been contributing to our project as well. And we've been using some of his analysis on our website. So he is a very special person to us. So please do that. And without further ado, we're going to say good night from me, because I am in Bulgaria and it's almost 11 o'clock here. And good day to anybody who is in a different time zone. And just last words from the Saker and Brian. Go ahead.
Brian, you go first.
Well, I would just like to, you know, thank the Saker for being here today. I mean, it was a pleasure to have this conversation, and it was an honor. I mean, I look back over 2 years, almost 2 years, and I think about, you know, why I got involved in South Front. You know, the Saker has this metaphor that he feels like a submarine in the desert. Well, you're not the only submarine out there. You know, we have a small flotilla of submarines in the desert, and the flotilla is growing. And your support of our project is, you know, very heartfelt, and we really appreciate it. And you were one of those voices that really woke me up and got me motivated to do something with, you know, my ability to write, or, you know, my viewpoint, or, you know, that frustration you always feel about, you know, why is this discussion, the real discussion, not happening? Why are these topics not being covered? Why is there, you know, the lies of omission of the mainstream media? We need to cover these things, and you're covering them, and you always covered them, and you were one of those first voices that I saw out there, and, you know, you definitely motivated me to do what I do with Southfront. So I really appreciate you being here and appreciate your work.
Well, it's a huge reward for me to hear that. If you help Southfront, really, that makes my day. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it tremendously. Anytime, I'll be willing to do that again. And thank you both from the bottom of my heart for doing what you're doing. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you, Saker. And just a last note, if you think that you can help us in any other way with to the audience, with contributing with articles or contributing with video makers, please contact us at info@southfront.org. You will be of great importance to us. But if you cannot, please give us a little donation. Every amount will be used to make videos or keep the project going. So thank you for this live stream. I hope to see you next Saturday. Have a great week. Goodbye.